Pick up, Representative Bell wanted to come and talk to us a little about the sex offender bills in general. She said she'd take 3 or 4 minutes. Let's invite her up now. And so why don't you come on up? Thanks.
Thank you so much, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Marie Bell. I'm a state representative in District 41. And I appreciate the opportunity to comment on a number of the bills that you'll be seeing today coming from the Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. I did not serve on this task force and learned of it as I became a member of the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives. But I have to say that my appreciation of that task force and what they accomplished during the interim has been tremendous. And the awareness that I now have of the problem is in a great part due to their efforts. And I would like to express that appreciation to all those who work so hard. The thing that has come to my attention is that there's a great cavern of pain and suffering out there that we have been overlooking for many years. And I believe that the reason we even unconsciously overlook it is because it's such a hard situation to deal with. And a person can hardly become involved without assuming some of the pain and suffering themselves. And the task force testified as to this in their own individual lives, and I have found it to be true since. I have become an advocate for the workings of this task force. I remember Representative Courtney coming to our committee and testifying that since he had been involved in this effort, individuals were stopping him in the hallways to tell him things that had happened to them earlier in their lives that they didn't reveal to anyone. And I can say the same has happened to me, that individuals in this building who have never divulged to another soul have come to me and told me about some of the pain and suffering that they suffered because of abuse during their childhood. The one thing that I have gathered from their testimony and the testimony of many of the victims and parents who came and who I invited to my office is that our present system is not working well. In fact, our present system, as it is set up, many times adds to their pain and suffering. And I believe that it's time for us as a responsible body to take our portion of the pain and suffering and take a stand to do something about this. Now, the reason I come to you and talk to you about this as you begin your deliberations is I believe it takes a different framework for us to deal with sex offenses against children, because it's a type of offense that we've never had to deal with before, and it has an impact on the victims in a way that we are not used to seeing. In fact, I believe, and as I've thought about this carefully, I commute back and forth from Eugene and spent quite a bit of time thinking about this, that I cannot personally think of a more heinous crime than sex abuse against children. And I ask myself the question, is it even more heinous than some of the war crimes that we have witnessed, the deprivation, experimentation, and tortures? And I've come to the conclusion that yes, it is by far the most heinous, and I will tell you why. In most wars, individuals experience atrocities with either friends or soldiers or fellow countrymen, and they have a cause to stand for, such as freedom or religion or their country. And they have a common enemy. All of these factors help an individual victim get through the battle and overcome the offense. But what about the children of sex abuse? Most likely, these individuals are completely alone in their pain. Many of them find it impossible to even describe the horror they suffer, and so they suffer in silence. Others remain silent because of the fear for their life or the life of their loved ones. Now, unlike those suffering for a cause, these crimes cannot even be explained, and the child might even wonder what they did to deserve such treatment. Or they may believe that there's something inherently wrong with them to feel that way. And finally, and maybe the hardest of all, is that it's even hard to release some of the pain by hating the enemy, because most often the enemy is a friend or a family member or someone the child is supposed to love. It's no wonder that nature in her mercy allows some blessed relief through amnesia for these victims. But unfortunately, there are others who return to the scene over and over again. I'd just like to tell you about one experience of a friend of mine. I received a phone call from my husband one day who had been counseling with a woman and found himself in the difficult position that she was under the desk in the fetal position, crying and moaning and reliving abuse that she had suffered probably 30 years ago. He didn't know what to do, so he called me and I came over. She would not respond except in violence to any male voice, and so I was able to talk to her, but I could very definitely tell she was living every part of that experience over again. It was just as real to her at that moment as it was at the original time. This is not uncommon, the amnesia, the return to the scene, reliving it over and over. And so I ask you, as you deliberate on these bills today, some of them may seem a step out of tradition. Some of them may seem to be a little beyond what we're used to when we deal with offenders. But as the task force probably testified to you, that these offenders are different than the offenders of other crimes. And as I have testified to you, the victims certainly have a different situation. So I plead with you to give them your most serious consideration and act as quickly as possible on them, so indeed that at the end of this session, all of us in this legislature can feel like we have accepted some of the responsibility for the pain and suffering that these individuals have gone through throughout their lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Bell, for the questions. Thank you. Okay, then let us, we have one bill which has come to us, which is scheduled, we've got people from Jackson County. Let me wait a few minutes on the expungement bill. Let's move ahead on some of the work sessions that we have before us, and then we'll get in a little while when we get people back in here. Let's start from the top and House Bill 2586. See if we can clear a few of those away. Ingrid, I don't think we have amendments to this one, right?
There are no amendments. This was last before the committee on May 27th, and basically this bill would authorize the court, but not require it, to order an evaluation of any person convicted of a crime in this state to determine whether the person is an alcoholic or a drug-dependent person. If the person were sentenced to prison, the Department of Corrections would then be required to place that defendant in an appropriate program if resources were available. And if the person were placed on probation, the court could require an evaluation. And if the evaluation indicated a need for treatment, could require treatment. The bill would also permit the court to order the defendant, as a condition of probation, to pay the cost of the private treatment program. That would also be a change from current law. There's only one comment that I would like to make. In Section 1 of the bill, it refers to the definition of an alcoholic in ORS 430.306 and the definition of a drug-dependent person in 430.450. The first section, which defines alcoholic, also defines drug-dependent person and uses the same terminology. So I would just suggest that maybe it would be better to use the same section definitions. It is identical to the definition in 430.450.
Oh, okay. So your suggestion, we use 306 all the way through?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Delete which?
So in line 6 on page 1 of the bill where it says ORS 430.450, we could simply say 430.306 or combine those as legislative counsel.
Okay.
Sees fit.
Are there objections to that technical amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, I think the bill is before us. Motion?
I move the bill.
Okay, Senator Hanby moves House Bill 2586 to the floor with the Dupress recommendation as we've amended it. Discussion. Senator Bunn.
So if someone is convicted of a C misdemeanor, how long can this requirement for a drug or alcohol rehab program be upon them?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, the period of probation that's available for misdemeanors is the same for regardless of the class of misdemeanor. So there is, under current law, up to 5 years probation, and you could require any time during that period.
Okay, so if they fail the probation, can the sanction be any longer than the original sanction for a C misdemeanor?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, no. 30 days is the maximum period of confinement for that offense.
Senator Springer.
Maybe counsel can help me out here, the sponsors, but when we talk in Section 2 about when the defendant is sentenced, the court may enter a finding. I realize it's discretionary, but I'm sure it's not going to take very long before this gets appealed on whether what the burden is. Is that by preponderance of the evidence, clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the judge has to make that determination? Because in one sense, by adding what may be a condition of probation, it seems to me we're, in effect, we're not exactly criminalizing it, but my sense is the court's going to apply a very tough test here and is going to suggest that, in fact, you're creating not a new element of an offense, but you're increasing the sanction based upon a judicial finding without the opportunity to have a jury decide that. And my sense is this thing's going to get challenged and it's going to get thrown out. I don't know if anybody can help me on that, but that's just my sense of what's going to happen.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, those are good issues. I frankly don't have any answer to them. The court makes a determination at this point as to who is in need of alcohol and drug treatment, assuming there's some indication in connection with the offense that that's part of the problem. This does amount to a determination that a person fits a certain classification, but that's the only respect in which it differs from what the court is already doing, basically.
I mean, it's my sense that the court now, in its inherent exercise of sentencing authority, has, as a condition of probation, require a person to, you know, stay off of drugs or alcohol. I don't think anyone's challenged that. But this judicial finding is the language I'm afraid is going to trip us up at the appellate level.
Well, it may. I guess I don't know how we could, what the, I don't know how one fixes it at the moment, or clearly they're saying when the court finds, shall direct the department to place deterrent in appropriate alcohol drug treatment in Section 3. So, I don't know how you can fit, you know, basically, you can't, I don't know how you would, there's nothing we can do now except either decide to forward the bill or not forward the bill, I think. I mean, unless there's someone here who has greater creativity about it. Senator Shoemaker.
I don't know whether this gets us, helps us get there or not, but I was looking at the section of the bill that deals with what on the probation situation, and that doesn't require the court to make a finding. It simply says that if the evaluation that's provided in Section 1 finds the defendant to be an alcoholic or drug-dependent person, the court shall order the defendant to enroll, participate, and so forth in a program. But you see, it skips that piece of the court making a finding. It just goes from the evaluation to the putting the person in a program. If they can do that on probation, which is a sanction, could they do it as well on the sentencing part? I mean, why? Maybe we could just explore deleting that the court has to make a finding, then, and just allow treatment program to be ordered if the evaluation indicates that the person is alcoholic or drug dependent.
Madam Chair, may I just note that even with respect to probation on page 4, lines 2 and 3, it indicates that that an evaluation isn't required if the court has already made that determination. So that
right.
also applies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But so it's not just an oversight.
No.
Yeah.
Well...
Well, I suppose the court makes findings when it issues an order as a condition of probation that a person pay restitution, and I don't know if that has been through any kind of challenge. I don't want to hold up the bill because I don't think we're going to get to a better answer here today. And I'm going to vote for it, but I think we may have some problems with that language.
Yes, Senator Bunn.
Another question now. the findings don't have to be based upon facts of the case. So does the alcoholism have to have been related to the case in order for that to be a condition? If you have a C misdemeanor that is totally unrelated to alcoholism, the judge still may find that you're an alcoholic and require you to enter an alcohol treatment program as a part of your probation.
Mm-hmm. Offensive littering. Trespass.
I would think any evidence before the court, including, but not limited to, the facts of the case. I think that's what it says.
Well, what?
That's on.
I see it.
That's on line 16.
Yeah, it doesn't say that the finding can go outside the evidence before the court.
Well, so it's on line 17, it says not limited to.
Mm-hmm. But it is evidence before the court, and it wouldn't be evidence before the court if it didn't have some relevance to the crime.
Madam Chair, in connection with sentencing, the defendant's history and use of any substances like that is ordinary before the court on a misdemeanor. Now, with sentencing guidelines, maybe not necessarily with respect to felonies anymore, but that kind of information mm-hmm. is generally available to the court in part of the sentencing evidence.
Senator Bunn.
Well, I'm concerned about alcohol and drug abuse, but, you know, if you take a crime that's not related to those, say, now we're going to straighten out your life in those areas. We can also say, you dropped out of school. Let's require you to go back to school as a condition of this. Or anything else that you don't do that we think you ought to be doing in your life. You know, great idea, but I don't...
Pay your child support.
Yeah. I'm concerned that we're taking, forcing an action to correct a problem that is not, that has not resulted in... That's correct.
Rosanna, you want to talk about
what the... Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was hoping also, Senator Springer, that line 16, 17, 18 would take care on page 1 of your concerns. I wish, when we had the hearings on the other side and when we had people here to testify, we had members from the courts who could tell about what is actually happening in the courts. But over 70 to 80% of your cases are related to substance abuse of some kind. And the purpose of this wasn't necessarily to point the finger at somebody who isn't doing anything related to alcohol or other drug problems and get them into treatment as much as those who have those problems that continue to perpetuate their life of crime, that we can get some help for them and help them get rehabilitation so that they can be productive citizens.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator
And I don't disagree with the effort to deal with those folks at all, but I have a problem when the net is so large that it catches other people that may have an alcohol problem, but we're now bringing it in when that alcohol problem did not cause the littering that was a C misdemeanor or whatever it was.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, what would be an example of that?
Okay, well, I think offensive littering is a C misdemeanor. If I was careless or stupid, whatever, I commit a C misdemeanor. But sometime earlier, I had had an alcohol problem, and the court was aware of that. So then they look at the record in sentencing and say, well, we sentenced him for, say it was minor in possession. So then you say, okay, now we know there's some alcohol problem. So we're deciding as a condition of your C misdemeanor on littering, you now have 5 years probation that you'll go through a successfully complete an alcohol rehabilitation program. And if you don't, then you're going to do jail time on your littering charge. I think the bill allows that to happen. Is that what you wanted to happen?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, no, absolutely, of course not. What we were trying to do was to get more people into treatment so they can rehabilitate. And I am going to have to leave this to the legal minds of this body. You any adjustments that you make so that you won't have that kind of problem. That wasn't the kind of problem we had. It was funding and getting people the help. We have so many, and having the programs available. Those were the kinds of problems we were addressing.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Habby, and then Senator Frank.
Would you mind redefining 16, 17, 18 to make sure, to ensure that the findings must be based upon facts of the case so that there's a direct tie in, I think?
Madam Chair and Senator Hamby, I, at this point, have no problem. In fact, that was what I was thinking, is we could just eliminate but not limited to. It might be those who work in the courts might have a good reason why they need that language, but I don't have a reason for that.
Okay, Senator Springer.
This was probably covered earlier. Maybe the folks in the House testimony covered this, but you know, Multnomah County, where I'm most familiar with the court system, there are probably hundreds of people convicted every week for misdemeanors, you know, all your traffic stuff, DWS, you name it, your shoplifts, lots and lots of cases. Did you have any sense of how many of those hundreds of cases might be subject to such a judicial finding or determination? Because, you know, the courts are so busy there, they're just moving the cases through left and right. And a judge usually is not going to stop to make this inquiry unless the DA is there or somebody's there to try to, quote, make the case. And so the net, you know, may be large, but it's not very fine in terms of actually stopping or intercepting people. And maybe that's well and good, but again, there's a lot of discretion there. And how is the court to be guided? You know, all of a sudden they jump on somebody because, you know, some disgruntled neighbor shows up or they're, you name it, somebody shows up and says, hey, I think this person's got an alcohol or a drug problem.
Senator Cohen, Chairman Cohen and Senator Springer, the first part of the bill talks about formal evaluations. And we would require that, except we got into the usual fiscal impact problems. The intent was that if someone, after a formal evaluation, has shown that they are chemically dependent and could benefit from treatment, that that should be part of their rehabilitation. And on the House side, that was not the issue. They are more concerned with, are there programs out there for the cases that we feel should go there? And we put a lot of mays instead of shalls, and if funds are available, if programs are available, and a lot of those, that wording was put in to the point where I wasn't sure we had anything when we got through.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure of the committee. If you want to try to rework this some more, we can set aside for a while. It's up to the pleasure of
Madam Chair.
Senator,
if I could just make a comment. I think that Senator Bunn's concerns, although I don't disagree with them, the present law seems to permit all kinds of conditions of probation which are not necessarily tied into the offense. If you look at 137540, was set out on pages 2 and 3 of the bill before the amendment to it appears at the bottom of page 3. There are lots of things here that can be done on probation, and requiring a defendant to enroll, participate, and successfully complete a residential treatment program for drug, alcohol, or mental health problems. There's no requirement that that be tied in to the case. It just goes back to the beginning of that subsection, which says, in addition to the general conditions, the court may impose special conditions of probation for the protection of the public or the reformation of the offender. But you see, so I think we've already kind of made that jump of allowing certain things to occur which are not necessarily tied in to the offense. And I don't know that this bill goes a lot beyond the pattern that's already in the law.
Senator Bunn.
Well, I'm not going to object to it. I'm concerned that we're trying to look for a solution. We should be looking for solutions that have tied to what caused the problem. But still, the intent of the bill is good.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Hamby has moved House Bill 2586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I clearly think we're going to have to flag this and see how it works and see if anything happens. Over triennium to see, you know, how, you what is in fact happening.
You don't think we need findings based on the facts? Madam Chair, also, I think, although the reference to the ORS also needs to be corrected in line 16, as well as... But if the committee is more comfortable tying the findings directly to the case, I certainly would be.
That might increase the jury question problem.
Well, that's a thought, yeah.
Okay. I think we're ready for one vote up or down, see where we are with it, knowing that this is an imperfect solution to a
humongous problem.
Yeah. Yes, a problem that isn't going to be solved by a piece of legislation, whatever piece of legislation we decide to do here. Call roll, please.
Senator Brockman. Senator Bunn.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's move to 22. That's right. We'll move on then. Let's wait till Bill gets lingered. We'll take up. We've got plenty of bills. We don't have to. We don't have to worry for 3051. This is the civil compromise bill, and we've been involved in some
3051.
3051. We've had variety of discussions about this bill. A couple of options are not satisfactory to the proponents of the bill. The A2 amendments, I think.
Madam Chair, the A2.
They will, at least they've gotten the direct parts that deal with physical assault and direct menacing and endangering other people. So we've taken out. You might tell us, Ingrid, what these amendments do.
Mm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, these amendments would just take out two of the categories of offenses which would not be subject to civil compromise, criminal mischief and telephonic harassment. So that would leave assault in the fourth degree, menacing, reckless endangering, and harassment. And
that would leave them still subject to?
That would leave those not subject to civil compromise.
We've got four left here. Assault.
And, Madam Chair, Assault 3 should be added. It is compromisable, and presumably if you didn't want to allow a compromise of Assault 4, you wouldn't want to allow a compromise of Assault 3.
Okay, well, let's put it in. We need to add that to the Dash 2 amendments. Is that right?
Yes.
In line 13. Yeah, we don't have to worry about where.
How would you do? Would we leave it up to legislative council to add Assault 3 that was not picked up on the House side that is now currently compromisable?
And
is that right?
Yes, Madam Chair. At the public hearing, I did provide members with the definitions of these other offenses, and I don't know if committee members don't have it. I can provide that too on reckless endangering and harassment.
Yeah, they were negotiating with Senator Shoemaker, and they decided that deferred prosecution was not a. So,
going to look at that in the end.
I suppose we could, with the whole domestic violence issue, but for the moment, I think we ought to try to do as much as do what we have here. Okay. We have the A2 plus the addition of Assault 3. I'm interested in moving these things. Okay. Chair would move the A2 amendments with the addition of Assault 3. Are there objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. and the chair would move House Bill 3051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman? Senator Bund?
No.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill? Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, could I be recorded as a yes?
Yes. Senator Hill would like to be recorded as a yes for House Bill 3051.
Thank you.
You want to be recorded as a yes on House Bill 2586, too?
I voted on that one.
Oh, okay. Excuse me, I can't even tell.
Well, the liability is kind of tripping me up here. I'm sure that comes as no surprise, but when we say on page 2 that an agency or a person who discloses information shall have immunity from any liability that might otherwise incurred or be imposed, that liability might not have nothing to do with the disclosure whatsoever.
Yeah, I agree with you.
If I'm reading it, I think it could be interpreted that way.
It might. Otherwise, then if...
Well, I would say we need to... I'd like to get your ideas and then back and bring it back again if we're going to do this. So let's turn around a little bit more on it and see where the committee is and figure out. Senator Springer, why don't you continue there?
Well, I'm just kind of hanging up on what the problem is and what the intent of that provision is. I'm not very keen on these immunity provisions. I think that's a known fact.
I clearly think we'd want to relate it to the specific action of disclosure or non-disclosure at a minimum there. Senator Bunn.
Madam Chair, are these provisions on page 2, line 12, just dealing with juvenile workers that would not apply to, for example, a public school teacher or counselor?
With the amendments, A6 amendments, which came through the committee discussion, they are limiting it.
Okay, I understand they would limit it, but the original bill was not limited, is that correct? So that under the original bill, a school teacher who had a student say something under the original bill would have been able to warn the person, but as amended, we're not dealing with that issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, the bill doesn't deal with that. It deals with juvenile court records, so a teacher would not have access.
Is a teacher at McLaren a juvenile caseworker then, or a detention worker?
That's a good question. I can't... I'm not sure I know.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't think we need the narrow definition in the A6 amendments. I think they may prove harmful. I think we need the shall, and we need to clear up the liability, but I don't think we need to. We don't need such a narrow definition that it only covers two people, and anybody who falls outside of that is denied the protection or responsibility of the bill.
Okay. Then you are also, but I want to double check and make sure that you're not inclined to deal with the A5 then, personally, Senator Bunn.
No. I think that someone who uses poor judgment and chooses not to disclose should not have us exempt them from liability. I would rather have somebody err on the side of disclosure. And if there was a gross negligence in not disclosing, as we drafted, or as we have the A5, we've freed them from liability.
Then I'm not sure we need the bill, because I think right now they have a duty to report. Actually, in current, maybe it's not explicit, but you deal with ramifications of the old court case down in California. There probably is a duty to report, and what these people are trying to do is get away from having to report circumstances that, in their judgment, are frivolous. And I think I just want to clarify the benchmarks for the committee. So I guess what you're saying is you agree with Tarasoff, which says they should report everything, and even if they have to say, we don't think this is really going to come to pass, but we're reporting.
Well, we do say in the professional judgment of the person, and to me that clarifies enough, but to put in a blanket liability exclusion is unreasonable. And that's what we would be doing with the A5, and I'd much rather see no bill than the A5.
Okay. Well, folks, what do you think?
Madam Chair, also, if we leave it open, is everyone comfortable with the terminology appropriate authority in line 15? Shall be disclosed to the appropriate authority.
Madam Chair, that language is, again, the same language used in the medical records.
They
have some case law definition there, but I can't tell you.
Okay.
Let's hear from the rest of the crew here. We have a menu that's wide open. I don't get a good sense of where the read is.
I'm with Bunn.
You're with Bunn. Springer's with Bunn.
So am I.
Hill is with Bunn.
That's scary.
You're talking about me specifically, Senator Bunn?
No. Yeah, the paper says I'm a willful chair who controls this committee on issues of these kind of matters. Okay, Senator Shoemaker is sort of on the other side, probably the dash.
He's rewritten the bill, Madam Chair.
No, I was wondering if it would make any sense to put in a something absent gross negligence or intentional misconduct.
Everybody used their own best
a person who wouldn't discloses or chooses not to disclose is immune.
No.
Whether that's fussing with it too much.
Well, I'm not sure you get them. I'd be willing to set this aside and see if people want to negotiate. I don't know where we get with the bill. Frankly, somebody has to say, let's Springer.
Well, if you're going to have somebody to try to work this bill, the fact situation that comes to my mind, the reason I raised my question about just what does that language mean in the portion I referenced. A kid says, I'm really mad at somebody, and if I can get my hands on a car, I'd run him down. And somebody leaves a set of car keys in the ignition of the car, and the kid gets the car. Sure enough, runs somebody down. Is that negligence, leaving the keys in the car? Probably. Is it against the law? Yes. It's statutory negligence. So, or leaves some other weapon out.
Yeah, I think at a minimum you got to narrow that liability if you're going to move with the bill. But I agree. So let's set it aside, bring it back. I think, Ingrid, we have a good sense of where the committee is. We'll circulate around some Springer amendments. Okay, folks, we'll probably be shooting for some A7 amendments, whatever they are. Okay, pass that one over. Let's move into the House Bill 2395, the beginning of our
we'll skip the peace officer engaging in community caretaking, because I think that'll probably take a while. I hear. Do you think that's going to be long, Ingrid? We could actually pick it.
I think not.
Oh, all right. Well, let's take House Bill 3448. It's right down on the list, folks. Yeah, so I'm not going to start it again. It's not late enough, yeah.
Community caretaking.
3448, community caretaking, peace officers. We've narrowed it so that they don't...
And Madam Chair, you should have A2 amendments.
Whoops, where are they?
And Hannon Gross.
Somebody's resting.
Yeah, it must have been. It's only 3448. They cut it in early.
Right. This is pretty wide.
Priority bill, it came in pretty late.
Have you talked to the sheriff of Multnomah County, Springer? He called me.
We traded phone calls.
I haven't had a chance to find out what he wants.
We didn't actually speak, however.
Do you know what he wanted?
I'm pretty sure he's...
Ingrid has been negotiating with... we're not ready with it yet?
I'm sorry. We seem to have lost our amendments, so we'll have to make more copies, Madam Chair.
Okay. A2 amendments are not here.
That's 49.
You might go through them, Ingrid, and tell us what they are, and they will.
Very well, Madam Chair. Basically, it would the amendments would delete subsections 3 and 4 from the bill. I beg your pardon. That's not correct. It would delete sub C from subsection 2, which is the right to perform any other act that a private citizen would be privileged to perform, and subsection 4. Sub 3 would remain in. Subsection 4 deals with seizure of evidence. Then in line 7 of the bill, the word oath would be deleted and the word duty substituted. So that as the bill would then read, officers would be authorized within the scope of their duty to enter and remain on premises for the purpose of preventing serious harm, etc., and would also be allowed to stop, redirect traffic, aid motorists, and enter vehicles for those same purposes. And as indicated in line 8, those functions include these activities but are not limited to those activities.
So tell us about the seizure then. What's remaining of seizure? What can a police officer seize?
So, Madam Chair, if this bill were to become law, an officer were asked to locate a missing person, entered property for that purpose, and upon entry within the scope of that authority, saw contraband that was recognizable on site as contraband, for example, a growing marijuana plant, could seize that property. That would not permit further search of other parts of the premises or seizure of additional evidence without a warrant. But basically, it would be the plain sight provision, which applies in situations where officers are where they are authorized to be. I believe Mr. Shepard may have some comments on the bill as well, Madam Chair.
Okay, does anyone, I don't see Mr. Shepard, I don't know if we need
He's
him.
He's in Quebec.
You've been in contact with him?
I have. He's not complaining. He feels this, I believe, in his present form is appropriate, Madam Chair.
Let's see where we are with this.
Move the amendments.
Senator Springer moves the A2 amendments to House Bill 3448. Are there objections to these amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, let me just raise a question.
Yep. Okay.
If the officer could seize contraband, which is in plain sight, could the officer, let's say an officer suspects that there is marijuana plants are growing in a residence.
Well, he can't do that.
Could he enter the premises in order to prevent serious harm to people because he believes those are there?
That's not in the
And then when he's in there, sees them and seizes them because they're in plain sight? I mean, could it work in that circular way? Or would he have to go in there because there's some other perceived danger? I can see that this could be used as a way to avoid having to get a warrant.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bunn.
Didn't removing lines 24 through 26 eliminate that question?
No, and not as I understand it, because you can still seize contraband which is in plain sight under the existing law. So if you suspect something is going to be in plain sight and you figure out a way to get yourself in the property, then you've made it.
Have we done something here that you can't do now?
Go in the property.
So if...
I suppose you could get a warrant to go on the property if you think something is in plain sight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should have to get a warrant.
Okay. But currently you cannot, you're saying that currently a police officer can't go on property to aid an injured person?
Madam Chair,
yes,
Senator Bunn, the case law on the subject basically says that an officer who does so as an ordinary citizen, not as an officer, and consequently is not authorized by statute to make any seizures.
Okay, but once they see that, then they could get a warrant to go in and seize, couldn't they?
Under current law?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So we're now taking it a step further, so that allows you to... Are we, Ingrid? No.
Well, I'm just
not anymore.
Wondering if that would be a basis for a warrant, since they would not be lawfully on the property. I'm not 100% sure that. Maybe Mr. Von Valkenburg could help us with that one.
If you're lawfully...
Who else is going to come up and talk to us about this caretaking
issue? Lawfully on the property
issue.
As a private citizen.
Peter Courtney would say, certified smart.
It would be no different from...
I'd like to have somebody explain to me how redirecting traffic is going to help you find a missing person.
Well, it allows you to go on something property to redirect traffic. Anyway, Senator Bunn, you had a comment.
Well, just a comment that I don't think it would be any different than an off-duty police officer observing something, and based upon that observation, getting a warrant and then dealing with it on duty.
Yes. Tiffany AG's office.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, the question from the committee pretty much collectively at this point is, what is the extent of the authority that this would grant, and if officers under current law see evidence in plain view while on the premises, say looking for a missing person, could they use that presently to obtain a warrant? And I believe the case law would say at this point no. The officer is on the premises in emergency capacity, not in a law enforcement capacity. They do not have authority to be where they are officially, and any evidence they see is not usable for law enforcement purposes, either to obtain a warrant or simply to seize in its own right.
Okay, Ross.
I agree with that. That analysis.
I might add, one of the cases that's on a memorandum that was given to you involves statements made to a police officer. He came to the scene with emergency medical personnel, and when he arrived with emergency medical personnel, he was informed that the husband had a drug overdose. That statement was not usable to obtain a warrant.
Okay, Ross, you have further comments about what the amended bill
I think this is the type of bill that the Broadwell case suggested. There still may be a warrant requirement, though. There is that footnote of Justice Carson that we discussed at some length. And I think we'll just have to have further litigation to determine if that's the case.
Even on contraband that's in plain sight?
It might well be.
Maybe we should make it specific.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we submit a memo that just summarized all the cases decided under Bridewell. And if you read down through them, I think you'll find that a warrant provision would not have worked in almost any of them. Perhaps Bridewell is the only case of all of them that it would might have been practical for the officers to obtain a warrant. Usually what we're dealing with is a situation in which is either an emergency or something that happens on the scene. There's an accident investigation, response to a residence in on a call regarding a drug overdose, drivers by the side of the road, hunched over steering wheels. These are not the kinds of situations in which a warrant would be feasible in any way. And the courts will simply evaluate under this bill whether in this particular situation a warrant would have been practical. The warrant requirement still exists under our Constitution. This statute does not and could not take that requirement away. The courts will evaluate that in each case as a matter of constitutional principle.
We okay, folks? Any problems with the bill as it's been amended here?
No, this is an agreement.
Okay. Thank you very much. Springer has moved the amendments. Hearing no objections to this amendment, before the bill is ready to go.
Move the bill as amended to the floor. Due pass.
Thank you. Senator Springer moves House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cohen, may I interrupt you?
Yes, please.
This bill might be interpreted.
You need to get your name on the record.
I'm Russ Shepard. I represent OCDLA. This bill might be interpreted to allow DUII roadblocks. I think it's both of our intention that should not be a legislative history.
That is certainly not the intent of the proponents, Madam Chairman.
Madam Chair, while we're on that point, the hypothetical that I raised about perceiving the danger to be the very thing you're trying to find and seize, sort of a tautology, do you see the bill as permitting that?
No, I think that would be a pretext, search and seizure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman? Senator Benn?
Aye.
3448.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. I want to thank folks for the hard work they did on this bill, including Ingrid, and especially Ingrid. Okay. Let's take up House Bill. What's your pleasure, Ingrid? Yeah, which one? So you want to have a preference on which one you start with? You want to do hearsay first or not?
That would be fine.
House Bill 2395. We have Chris is here, came from Deschutes County. Chris Gardner, the DA there. So Ingrid has amendments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically this bill does five things to the evidence law. First of all, it says that a statement made to a professional counselor by anyone for the purpose of diagnosis or treatment of a disorder arising from sex abuse would not be inadmissible under the hearsay law under this bill. So that's any age of person who sought counseling for the results of sexual abuse. Secondly, it provides that a statement made by a child victim who is under 18 years of age, so up to the age of 18, regarding an act of sexual conduct would also not be inadmissible under the hearsay rule if the child testified as a witness. So if you have a witness who's present, you can admit prior statements by that person concerning an act of sexual conduct. Thirdly, it would provide that a statement made by a child victim under 13 years of age, whether or not that witness was available. So if the witness is unavailable to testify at trial, if a child under 13 made a statement concerning an act of sexual conduct, it could be admitted, providing certain corroborative evidence was present. Now, that changes current law by raising the age from 10 to 13. Under the bill passed last session, that is the rule with respect to children 10 or younger. This would raise it to 13. Fourthly, the bill would provide the same or a similar exemption in civil cases from the operation of the hearsay rule for children 13 or younger. Finally, the bill would provide that a child under 10 would be permitted to testify by means of audiovisual transmission from a location where the party was not necessarily present. So if it were a criminal defendant, the criminal defendant need not be present where in the same room as the complaining witness, the child. You have dash A4 amendments, which do a couple of things. They completely delete the first exception to the hearsay rule that was described. That would be a statement made to a counselor by any person. Secondly,
and I'd listen, that's an amendment that I requested, having been through this last session. We rejected it as a committee last session because it was overly broad and doesn't say it can be anyone really, and just automatically to have that come in as hearsay would just really be, I think, there's no definition to it. So that amendment was at my request, and we heard from the proponents that they weren't sure why the House Committee added it back in. It's not particularly of that moment to them either, so I just speak to that directly. Okay.
The second amendment is on page 3 of the bill. In line 7, after the word misconduct, it would add the word at issue, and that is to distinguish complaints of sexual misconduct about the offense which is charged and complaints that relate to prior incidents. So this would clearly limit it to complaints relating to the charged conduct or the conduct at issue in the civil case. In line 36 on page 3, the language beginning in the middle of line 36, and apparent, would be deleted, and the balance of that line deleted, and that was in response to the testimony of a witness before the committee who basically felt that it wasn't proper to advise the court that a parent might be an appropriate, suitable adult to have present in the courtroom. And so this would leave the court with the full discretion to choose anyone as a suitable adult, but would not point out the, quote, non-offending parent as one such.
If you recall the testimony, we had a young woman here who testified saying that her mother wasn't, and that she felt it was really inappropriate to sort of have her mother there,
right,
who was part of the aiding and abetting. And this would leave, as Ingrid said, the court open for choosing someone who would be the most suitable for support of the child.
Yeah. And finally, Madam Chair.
Okay, as it would be worded, then it would be the presence of the attorney and legal guardian or other suitable adult.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And finally, Madam Chair, the changes on page 5 under the dash 4 amendments would eliminate those changes so that a child's testimony could not be taken outside the presence of the accused or the party in a civil case.
And that takes out the video. Is that it? Tell me.
It does. The law passed last session permits the use of the video recorded testimony. However, it does require that the party or in a civil or criminal case be allowed to be in the same room. There was conflicting testimony before the committee about whether the Oregon Constitution would permit the defendant in a criminal case to be in a room other than the same room where the witness was testifying.
Yeah, I guess this was part of also comments from the woman who testified saying she thought it was important to be in the courtroom to get that sense of support and sort of verification, or so that she could get a clear understanding that she had been in court. Vindication is the real word for it. So these are the amendments. Chris, you want to come forward and speak to them if you have any concerns that came to some degree?
My name is Chris Gardner. I'm from the ODAA. Thank you. I have no objection to any of the amendments. Ingrid and I also discussed the age being raised to under 13. I have no objection to your reconsidering that either, if that's an issue before you. I would like to comment just real briefly on the amendment to the videotape testimony part. It has a list of people, as the statute currently exists, that says only the judge, attorneys for the parties, and I'll skip the rest of it to get to the relevant part, may be present during the child's testimony. It does not require that any of those people be present, and it appears to leave that at the discretion of the judge. So I don't see where the change that was done by the House would change existing law, and it would, I think there's an interpretation of how this is currently written that would allow a judge to exclude a party, a defendant, say, and bring that case before the Oregon Supreme Court. So, and I have no problem with any of the amendments.
So, I guess, are there are there objections to the A4 amendments? Senator Hanby moves the A4 amendments. Are there objections? Hearing none, so what? Senator Shoemaker.
A couple of questions. I noticed that on line 35 and page 4, the reference back to Section 18A is still dealing with children under 10 years of age, whereas for at least some purposes, we changed the age to 13. I want to be sure that that wasn't inadvertent.
I guess
there still is a distinction.
I think there is an open question about whether we want to bring it up to that large of an age, given some of the testimony that we had from victims here who felt it was important that they, for their own purposes, come forward and be present and be vindicated by the court, if you will, and that it was a good response for them at that. Whatever, and I guess that you may hear different ages of victims or different victims with different.